listening now.
Yeah, let's listen.
Okay, so I apologize if this is a little long. What I'm hoping to do is give kind of a big general overview of what I consider to be kind of the scope of the manifesto as a whole, and relate that to kind of the larger question of what the relevance of Marxism is today. Okay, so the Communist Manifesto, an old dead thing like this guy, 160 years old, maybe more, passed over by the relentless flow of history. Is it at all relevant to us today? One response: sure, obviously. Capitalism is in the midst of crisis of mammoth worldwide proportions. And forgive me if I read a little bit. Inequalities have deepened the world over. Productivity has risen dramatically over the last 40 years, but workers see few of the toil's benefits. Wages stagnate. Unions have been on steady decline. Foreign policy is rigged to support the global status quo. And look, China seems to be riding out the disastrous wave. Or perhaps another answer to the relevance of Marxism, we ought to give a tepid maybe. Marx is a really good critic of capitalist society, but he was overly totalitarian, a class reductionist. He neglected the role of the middle class. He didn't understand the importance of the individual, etc., etc. The Communist Manifesto then reveals some flaws in our contemporary society, of which we should take note, and we ought to use the machinery, something like the machinery of the liberal state, to alleviate the various sufferings. Or a third possibility, the answer is just no. It's completely irrelevant. Capitalism has continued, despite Marx's diagnosis of its moribund character, to transform the world. You look at indicators like infant mortality, average age of death, etc., the world over, even regardless of development, underdevelopment, seems pretty okay compared to all of human history. Capitalism is the tide that lifts all boats, if some more slowly than others. I think Adam Smith said that the worker in modern capitalism is like the African king of ages past. In all three of these views, Marxism is either a set of doctrines or a tool for social reportage, judging harshly in the injustice of capitalist society and leaving us with the desire to make it more equal and morally just. I want to take a slightly different approach to what Marxism is, adopting for the moment what I consider to be the spectacles that the manifesto itself gives us. To answer the question of whether the Communist Manifesto is relevant today, I'll proceed by using its own method in order to illuminate it as an object. So what is the method of the Communist Manifesto? I offer two key characterizations. First, Marx as a historical method. The assertion is simple: nothing is eternal. Forms of life are characterized by birth and death. By viewing a given social fact with only the present in mind, we lose the fact that it actually doesn't exist now, but is in fact the result of a previous process of transformation, and has in fact already been passed by, is already in the process of transforming into something else. The past and the future are then bound up with the present, so we will address the Communist Manifesto historically. Second, methodologically, the manifesto is concerned with history insofar as freedom is what's at stake in the story of humanity. Can the promise of self-determination that flew on the banners of the French Revolution be the meaning of history? For Marx, it's truly up for grabs whether history will be one damn thing after another, or whether it will be the story of human development and liberation. Will history be the story of chance and brutality, of inhuman forces and dumb disaster? The future will retroactively decide on the character of the past. Sort of odd temporal character. History and freedom may intertwine, or they may prove to be each other's absolute antitheses. I'd like to offer maybe a motto that I was thinking of as I thought of the Communist Manifesto, which is from Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Nietzsche says, "Man is something that should be overcome." The manifesto, I think, is in some ways an elaboration, a concretion of this Nietzschean theme. Man, historical humanity, persons as we have so far known them, is something that should be overcome in a new phase of self-creation and change. The Communist Manifesto is a call to a concrete project of human freedom. I'm going to take us through each of the four parts of the Communist Manifesto, and then kind of return to this bigger issue of the relevance of Marxism today. Okay, so the first section is the bourgeois and proletarians, and this part is obvious. Bourgeois equals bad, proletarians equals good, and done, finish. But for a communist pamphlet, Marx spends an awful lot of time actually praising the bourgeoisie. Marx, the arch-revolutionary, says, "The bourgeoisie historically has played a most revolutionary part." A claim like this would seem to rankle everyone's feathers. The bourgeois, deathly afraid of Robespierre's shadow stalking every revolution. The socialist, lamenting the cruelty and horror of life in alienated bourgeois society. Leftists and right-wingers would often converge in an anxiety over capitalism's shockingly destructive character. But not Marx. Bourgeois society's most important and possibly most progressive characteristic for Marx is its hitherto untold capacity for change. If the history of the world is the history of class struggles, and I'll return to this claim later, there is something particularly important and new about the transformative character of capitalism. The dynamics of bourgeois society are restless, ceaselessly transforming whatever lies in their path. Give an extended quote, probably my favorite. "The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production, and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast frozen relations melt with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air, all that is holy is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind." End quote. Sorry for the extended quote, only have a couple of those. So part of what Marx is trying to describe here is the simple historical fact that the bourgeoisie itself rose to power as part of a revolutionary process, which is, you know, a kind of glib, fine rejoinder to anyone who wants to justify the present, sub specie aeternitatis, forgive my horrible Latin, as if, you know, the present is what always has been, always will be, etc. But Marx is after, I think, more than this relatively trivial point. He wants to analyze the peculiar dynamic of capitalism. Attempts to remain on firm ground are illusory and doomed to failure. No matter how much the bourgeoisie itself might want to freeze things in place to stabilize the ceaseless flux, certainly capitalists are not always fans of the instability that comes with economic crises, technological advance, labor conflict, regime change, etc. Even the attempts to solidify the present push, restlessly toward something else. But what is that something else? What kind of transformations has bourgeois society wrought? Bourgeois society, for one, according to Marx, created a new internationalism. Capital proceeds fundamentally without borders. Technology flies across the world. Prices are set internationally. Limitations in domestic demand compel new markets to open. Barriers between self-sufficient economies that meet for the occasional trade or war are exploded. The bourgeoisie, I quote, "by the rapid improvement of all instruments of production, by the immensely facilitated means of communication, draws all, even the most barbarian nations, into civilization. The cheap prices of commodities are the heavy artillery with which it batters down all Chinese walls." End quote. So too, in bourgeois society, barriers between human beings disintegrate. Aristotle presumed that slavery was necessary because there were two different kinds of people. Not even kinds of people in some ways, two different kinds of beings. Slaves and aristocrats, who had entirely different natures. One was suited towards labor, one was suited towards leisure. In capitalism, everyone has to go to the market to survive. Some are fortunate enough to enter it with the means of production. Others have nothing to sell but their hides. Everyone must interact with commodities, though, to live. The worker is just perhaps the most typical figure of capitalist life because the worker is herself a commodity. To keep myself alive, what else can I do? I sell my capacity to labor, I become an object, to maintain whatever life I can eke out as a subject. Back to bourgeois society. Bourgeois society also revolutionizes the labor process, creating untold riches with ever-dwindling labor inputs necessary. I quote, "The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than of all preceding generations together. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor?" End quote. Bourgeois society, creates the potential to harness human forces in ways hitherto unimaginable in order to create massive material wealth and technological marvels. So the liberal philosophical dream of thinkers like Immanuel Kant, Thomas Paine, Adam Smith, of a world of equal individuals interacting in a society that allows them their full development as human beings in peace and progress, is rooted, I think, in something real, some real form of appearance of bourgeois society. Bourgeois society is something unique in human history and potentially progressive. Calling Marxism anti-capitalism is thus a simplification, even a mystification. But to understand why Marx does not then hang up his hat and become Milton Friedman, we must understand how bourgeois society's restless change is also limited, how it frustrates its own progressive tendencies. Capitalism's dynamic has the kind of strange character to be something like the old French saying, la plus ça change, la plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more things stay the same. For instance, the kinds of crises capitalism produces. The image ought to be familiar. Quote, modern bourgeois society, with its relations of production, of exchange, and of property, a society that has conjured up such gigantic means of production and exchange, is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld with whom he is called up by his spells. Marx got it from a Goethe poem, this image, Zauberlehrling, or the Sorcerer's Apprentice, as did Walt Disney a few years later. Those who are familiar with the latter inferior work. The Sorcerer's Apprentice uses his magic to conjure assistants to accomplish his work, a living broom. As we know, though, he cannot control the broom. In the poem, the master steps in to take matters under his firm hand and control the chaos. For Marx, what's interesting is it's the master, it's the sorcerer himself who has lost control, not the assistant. The mastery of the bourgeoisie is a sham. This is particularly clear in the crisis of overproduction. Here again must be emphasized capitalism's historical uniqueness. Most of human history has been characterized by the problem of scarcity. Crises come, to put it very simply, from bad crops, which mean insufficient food, which mean death. Nature presents profound limits to humanity's self-realization. Instead, the modern world is strangely characterized by crises of plenty. Labor is too efficient. A new machine or a new process triples efficiency, so the firm downsizes, thrusting the workers back into the vagaries of the labor market rather than allowing them to sit back and sip piña coladas. Goods are overproduced and sit, collecting dust in warehouses. Countries around the world are too good at specializing their food crops and producing in massive amounts, so when prices rise, their people cannot eat. When modern economics enshrines scarcity as the essential problem of all human beings, it is in some sense behind the times. It is not natural scarcity that's the problem in bourgeois society, but the organization of society that blocks the manifold potential for human self-realization that capitalism creates. Class struggle in capitalism is both a new development in and the revealed secret of all class struggles past. Class struggle is not ultimately over the distribution of goods. It is a struggle over human destiny, over whether our social powers will benefit or destroy us. This crisis of bourgeois society that I've kind of been talking about a bit sort of economically also has a political form, which already manifested itself in the French Revolution. Political change, the Titanic of political change, hits the iceberg, if you will, of the economy. This independent realm with mysterious laws to which all must bow in obeisance. Capitalists have mammoth control over resources and thus make political equality a mere formality, since the state is ultimately on their side. The economy demands it. Slaves in Guadeloupe want to become free in the name of French Revolution. The economy says no. The individual bourgeois can hire and fire the worker, and the nominally equal worker has no individual recourse. It's the economy, stupid. How can freedom and democracy survive in light of the limitations the mode of production poses to political will? Finally, the crisis of bourgeois society, its inability to meet the possibilities that it had created and the promises that it had made, has a subjective side too, the development of the proletariat. All too often, Marxism is consigned to social analysis of the objective world, the economic, etc. But Marx's whole point is that the peculiar possibility of capitalism lies in its human, all too human, character. The crisis of capitalism is also the slow coming to consciousness of the potential inheritor to the bourgeoisie in the realization of modern freedom. This again is its objective side. So I think we're somewhat familiar, workers are concentrated into cities, production sites like factories. Despite the wonders of the world being created every day, they are listless, frustrated, miserable, poor, The commodity, the essential form with which we interact and which shapes our lives, is occasionally a person in the form of a worker, a person that might make some demands to change their status as an object. And that sort of pivots us into also the kind of subjective side of what it means to be a worker for Marx. Workers try to assert their rights, try to become full subjects in society. They try to develop within the bounds of bourgeois society, and they reach certain limits. They fail again and again, but may recognize something significant in their failure. They may transform that failure into the condition for a more radical success. They may realize new possibility. They may remake themselves, and thus the whole social world which is produced by them. As Marx put it in a later document, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the workers themselves. Man might self-overcome. Now I'm going to, apologies for the length, but now part two, proletarians and communists. So the proletariat represents the possibility of capitalism's most typical product, the commodity, and its most typical result, the crisis, of becoming self-conscious. What's communists got to do with it? Marx puts it like so. The communists do not form a separate party opposed to the other working class parties. They have no interests separate and apart from those of the proletariat as a whole. The wrong way, I think, to take this is to start a debate on the nature of political parties and trade unions, of vanguards and mass parties, etc., etc. This is part of the historical legacy with which we must eventually cope, but I want to kind of hone in and shed a light on what this statement says, I think, about Marxist politics more generally. It is not what particular shape the political struggle takes in any given moment that is important for Marx. Organizational form is, at least in part, determined by specific conditions. It might mean a party, it might mean something else. What does not change is that Marx saw communism as the attempt to reveal and make conscious the potential meaning of the proletarian struggle. Proletarian struggle might reach beyond the struggle of oppressed versus oppressor that has thus far characterized human history. It might allow us to take a qualitative leap out of the miserable conditions that have thus far characterized humanity. This is a far cry from the eternal struggle idea that characterizes both contemporary liberal and radical thought. Both assume that the fundamental coordinates of human history, the David-Goliath face-off, sort of simply, are here to stay. They may identify different victims, the liberals and the radicals, but the idea that the struggle continues eternally for rights characterizes both. Capitalism, thinks Marx, might change the rules of this loaded game. Nietzsche, again, I was reading Nietzsche when thinking about this. Apologies for all the Nietzsche, but I think it makes sense. Man is a rope tied between beast and overman, a rope over an abyss. Communism, in some sense, would be the Pascalian wager for freedom rather than for God. Being a communist is to act as if freedom exists. So what do Marxist communists do? They point out and bring to the front the international and historical character of the movement. Quote, the communists are distinguished from other working class parties by this only. One, in the national struggles of the proletarians of the different countries, they point out and bring to the front the common interests of the entire proletariat, independently of nationality. Two, in the various struggles of the various stages of development, which the struggle of the working class against the bourgeoisie has to pass through, they always and everywhere represent the interests of the movement as a whole. End quote. Marxist communists, then, are tasked with continually foregrounding for the proletariat the links between the past, present, and future of self-creation beyond the economy as we know it. They push forward the universal character of this change, its meaning for humanity as a whole, and as he goes on to do for the rest of the section, they remind the bourgeoisie, and most importantly the workers, that what they seek to do is realize the potentially liberating developments of the present. Real freedom, real individual development, real choice and consent in intimate relations like the family, real internationalism, real intellectual inventiveness, all these Marx shows to be the natural children in some sense, or the possible children, if only the sperm reaches that egg, of bourgeois society. As is the proletariat, the natural child of bourgeois society. This is especially important because I think confusion on this issue is frequent. The proletariat is the center and essence of capitalism for Marx. Any expectation for change and progress, then, does not proceed from the margins inward, from some explosive outer force ripping apart a nasty totalized whole. Instead, it corresponds to making that totalized whole a conscious and therefore changeable society. Marx critiques those whose only interest in the proletariat is its misery as the, quote, greatest suffering class. It is precisely because the proletariat is capitalism's most typical product that the individuals in it might be able to finally end humanity's prehistory. Okay, part three, socialist and communist literature. We arrive at perhaps the most underrated section of the manifesto. Here Marx lays out clearly the key method by which communists will accomplish the tasks he has set out for them, to be conscious of and pushing for the full set of possibilities the present offers up. It is through critique of inadequate responses to the present that the future becomes clearer. This section is sort of theoretical critique of the theoretical leadership. Marx delineates several of the different currents running through the radical movements of his day. We do not need to let the specifics of which party was which, etc., hold us up. I do want to mention, though, a couple of forms of consciousness he discusses that are reminiscent, I think, of still things that still persist. For instance, Marx critiques leftists who attempt to roll back the wheel of history. Under this category, all nostalgic forms of socialism based on the good old days of peasant production, of nobles who really cared about their serfs, of proper native hierarchies a la Avatar versus nasty Western military hierarchies, etc. Then there are the kind-hearted, those who want all the good of capitalist society without the bad. As Marx puts it, they desire the existing state of society minus its revolutionary and disintegrating elements, the best part. In the name of sympathy with the suffering of the oppressed, they try to manage the terrible problems of the modern world, thereby sidestepping also the potentials that the modern world presents. I'm reminded here of Nietzsche's Last Man, who, quote, can no longer give birth to a star. Alas, the time of the most despicable man is coming, he that is no longer able to despise himself. We might add other categories for the present, the suffering worshippers who flit from struggle to struggle to give some meaning to their existence in an unfree world, the community fetishists who prefer a local to a foreign tyrant, etc., or a distant tyrant. We don't need to expand ad infinitum, apologies for my Latin, here. The important lesson is that the Communist Manifesto poses as essential a critique of its present-day left and its inadequate responses to the possibilities created by capitalism and the proletariat. The proletariat might be the, quote, self-conscious independent movement of the immense majority in the interest of the immense majority. How might this self-consciousness be achieved? By a constant, ruthless critique of its own limits with an eye toward how they might be transcended. This yoke is not easy, nor is this burden light. Finally, the very final section, positions of communists in relation to the various existing opposition parties. Marx ends the manifesto with a reflection on his moment, the rising tide of Europe-wide liberal revolutions that would follow mere weeks after the publication of the manifesto in 1848. His view on the bourgeoisie's potential to complete its own revolutionary political process became much darker after the failure of these revolutions. The bourgeoisie was cravenly willing to sacrifice freedom to, quote, law and order. But the relation between communists and these political movements is the same as the relation to the aforementioned socialist theorists and the relation to the proletariat itself, I think. Marx again emphasizes the engagement of communists with the left of its day, that it might clarify and distill the left's, and so capitalist society's, limits and potentials. Critical engagement, the tasks of the proletariat ahead, internationalism, the communists, quote, in the movement of the present also represent and take care of the future of the movement. The communists, then, are a kind of caretaker, not of a holy book by Marx, the dead guy, but of a certain historical possibilities that might change the character of human history thus far. Again, Zarathustra, I love him who justifies future and redeems past generation, for he wants to perish of the present. So, now to kind of tie it together, that's my kind of scopic view of the manifesto. The manifesto was written in a hopeful moment, 1848, a rising tide of potential political change. But it also reflects an awareness of failure, of the incapacity of bourgeois society to realize the goals it has made possible and under whose banner it has fought. In short, liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, fraternity. And the failure, shortly thereafter, of the liberal movements across the continent, along with the massacre of workers in France in the June days of 1848, only confirmed that bourgeois society cannot fulfill even its more limited promises. Rosa Luxemburg, the German communist, claimed that humanity faced a choice, socialism or barbarism. Marx discusses in the manifesto the potential ruin of the contending classes as a result of the class struggle. Best of these all, these sort of quotes, I think, might be Engels, who in his The Origin of Private Property, Family, and the State characterizes civilization thusly. Every advance is likewise a relative regression, in which the well-being and development of the one group are attained by the misery and repression of the other. Everything engendered by civilization is double-sided, double-tongued, self-contradictory, and antagonistic. The Communist Manifesto calls on us to redeem the barbarism that civilization has wrought and to put it at the service of human self-transformation. It proceeds by focused attention on historical possibility and a critique of the left for falling behind what might be in order to reconcile itself in one way or another to what is. If Marx's moment was one in which the failure of liberalism was becoming apparent, Surely ours is one in which the failure of the left in all its forms, especially Marxism, is the reality with which we are confronted. What relevance might Marxism have today, then? It seems to me that it's Marxism in a way that so acutely calls us to analyze its relevance, first of all. Does bourgeois society still retain this potential? How is the left falling behind the ability to realize these potentials? Marxism, I think, at its best, asks us to take a world historical view, to see the problem of freedom in its full international and historical depth. And it asks us to, as Nietzsche coquettishly puts it, become what we are. Nietzsche claims that, quote, to become what one is, one must not have the faintest notion of what one is. Indeed, we do not know what we are or might be. We might, through political action and critique, be able to shape our collective destiny. But the missed opportunities add up. The failures are no longer lessons leading us to inexorable progress, but quicksand in which we are sure to sink. Quote, the tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. 18th Brumaire by Marx. Marxism might be the shovel we use to start digging our way out of the shit of the dead generations, to transform them into a horrifying but cathartic prelude to human freedom. Again, I end with the Nietzsche quote, man is something that should be overcome. Sorry for the length.
Anyone have any questions? I'll shoot one off. Oh, you have one?
Yeah.
There was a part where this section of the socialist literature, where he was critiquing socialist literature, and he was critiquing some of the people before him, like the Richard Owens and Saint Simon is his name, and Fourier, who are these kind of commune-like people where they would try to, you know, gather a group of people in a community where they could prefigure or imagine what a future world beyond capitalism, not Saint Simon so much, but, you know, try to imagine what a future beyond capitalism would look like. So my question, and then you pose the question of Marx is critiquing the present and the kind of historical problematics that led up to that. So I'm wondering, why wasn't Marx trying to prefigure a communist future? Why was he trying to critique the now and the old, rather than saying this is what communism is going to look like?
I mean, I have thoughts about some of these things, but people should feel in to like chime in and kind of make this a little more of a discussion. I mean, I know like me sitting here at the head and Mr. Authority position is not exactly conducive to that, but if people have comments, like just open in. I would answer, I mean, I actually to some extent skipped over that critique because it's in some ways the most interesting. But I mean, Marx's critique of those socialists is not so much in some ways that they had a plan. More importantly, it's that all of them thought that their plan was to be accepted by kind of the social forces as they exist, i.e. the bourgeoisie, essentially, and that the bourgeoisie could then sort of realize this plan out of the goodness of their heart, out of realizing that, like, society could be well reorganized, et cetera, et cetera. So what Marx says is that the issue of self-emancipation, of for a good society to exist, that meaning human beings actually themselves taking hold of their collective destiny, and this being importantly tied to the historical development of these people called the workers who were experiencing a certain kind of life in capitalism and who were both succeeding but also incredibly failing in the attempt to sort of overcome its contradictions, that is in some ways the real problem. Like, it's not, and I think it's actually, it might be vis-a-vis them where he says that like the proletariat is just the most suffering class for them. Like, they're just, like, people who have really shitty lives. And, I mean, this becomes, like, you know, Saint-Simon writes all these, like, letters. He writes, like, letters to Napoleon. Like, everybody who's in power, basically, and politically, like, turmoil France over the early 19th century. Like, Saint-Simon starts writing letters to them and being like, look, I've got this really great plan for how to reorganize society. And, like, if you only listen to me, like, the entire world will be perfect. And so it's like, Napoleon, like, yeah, I never liked that, like, directory. Oh, they sucked. And then, like, oh, King, like, oh, that Napoleon, he was awful. But you're much more rational. Like, the people they were appealing to, all of them were the bourgeoisie, not the proletariat.
And I think also there's something along with that, something really strange about, non-radical about thinking that you can actually see and plan the future. It also requires a great deal of arrogance to think that you can divest yourself so totally when the future hasn't already come. about the future and projects it even in our society, you have a kind of Jetsons idea where things are happening that are fantastic, you're in outer space, but actually everything's exactly the same, like somebody comes home in time for dinner, like da da da, so on and so forth. And so I think that in these communes too, the same sort of thing was happening. In a sense, they would project these futures, but they were so clearly not free from their ideas of the present that they started to replicate even in their commune ideas. And so even if they tried to like hearken back to past ages, they were still just reinstating certain things. And you can see that even now, I think, presently in the sort of communes that are built. So, I mean, I think that's also part of the problem.
Were they just more interested in the material changes, such as, you know, the manner in which they acquired their goods and acquired social reproduction rather than the society itself?
Yes, to a lot of that, but also someone like Fourier was like, this is like a change in human nature. Like, he classified people as having something like 800 different personality types, and if you had the right combination, like a pair of each, you put them in like deadlines that everyone would get along and everything.
Also, the seas were going to be made into lemonade,
true,
which
and
was
like
a beautiful dream. I think we should keep that alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
so it was both material changes and like ownership of nature production, but it was also like, this is about like human personality, and like Fourier makes
And Owen makes the same. So, you know, Owen has sort of, he's like a radical scientific determinist or like social determinist. He's like, all of human being is based on social structure. So it doesn't matter what you're born as, it just matters how you're trained. And so if we have proper training that like encourages people to be creative and individual and cooperative, et cetera, then human beings will be great and individual and cooperative, et cetera. And Marx recognizes that this was like very important and like, and inspired a lot of people, and inspired movements, etc. His issue is sort of like in his generation, where there are like actual worker struggles going. These people are like a tiny little sect where you like swear an oath on Fourier or like on Saint-Simon or whatever. You know, if people want to go to the Church of Positivism in Brazil, in fact.
Yeah, there is.
and come to a Saint-Simon student.
Like weeks ago, and I couldn't believe they have like.
Or Dem Ed Progresso on the Brazilian flag is order in progress, Comte.
The flag. We have to
change the flag. I think there's a couple things. There's a historical critique, and I think he's going to say Owen is behind the times. It was good at the time that his followers were not, you know, keeping up with the course of history. That, I think, is the point about we have no aims but the movement of the proletariat. They are sectarian things. Fourier, Saint-Simon, I think they're just fascists. He just understood that those kinds of societies would just never, ever work. That's just not how society works. At least Owen's kind of building out some kind of communal production, but like Fourier was, you know, telling you what kind of place where, you know, place settings you should sit where.
Although even, I mean, Owen, you know, Owen had early forms of like the nicer shadings of worker discipline.
Owen
they used to
like
give people flags
like
for
Dooley,
like.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, let him be cool. the other thing is, I forgot what the other question was. He also didn't think it could such things like Proudhon's system could work on a societal basis. So you could have a commune, you could have kibbutz. But, you know, you can't have socialism as a whole in one society. And there is something to the case that, like, capitalism is unifying humanity under a single economic system.
And in part, I mean, not only that you can't, but in some ways it's not even desirable. Like, living on an agrarian commune, forcing all human beings to live on agrarian communes, regardless of how they plan on living their lives, would be actually regressive.
Well, that's if it was imposed, sure.
Yeah.
Fourier definitely.
That's the
some ways Marx here is a, I think, a classic Rousseauian. I mean, Rousseau, you know, right in the Second Discourse on Inequality, describes the sort of absolute degradation that the onset of civilization brings about, and the kind of the deep-seated horror at the modern world and everything about it in some ways. But in The Social Contract, he's like, but if everything weren't so horrible, we would be just full of thanks for modernity, because it's in the pre, like in the state where we all have our individual plots, and you know, this is like even before we have language, so it's a little bit of exaggeration here, but you know, we're not even human, we're not moral beings, like we're not in a society, we're not interacting with each other, we're not, like, we're incredibly limited. And so, like, if only civilization weren't so awful, we would, like, get down on our knees and thank it constantly, is what Rousseau says. I mean, it seems to me relevant, should I put this? Insofar as what Marx tries to show in some ways is both the, you know, the way in which they are a part of their time, and they can in some ways critically illuminate something that was true of their time. So they reveal, like Fourier, et cetera, reveal something true about capitalist society, in fact, a lot. And be inadequate both because of sort of the later developments, i.e. the moment historically where Marx is, where certain kinds of things have been revealed that were not the case then, perhaps, that, you know, it's not, the bourgeoisie is not going to be the only class that ever has any, like, balls in history, maybe. And also, not only later developments, but also, like, certain kinds of limitations that were constitutive of their moment. So I think the, in some ways, the best way to critique someone is to reveal, like, internally the way in which their own thought limits itself, but also points beyond itself, also offers certain kinds of promises that a better position or a better movement or a better whatever are willing to take up. And it seems to me like one can make a very similar claim to, like, whatever, you know, I mean, I gave a kind of, like, glib, like, thing about some various kind of tendencies on the contemporary left, and, you know, Marx can be quite glib. But at the same time, like, one should recognize that these are reactions to socio-historical processes. These are people trying to understand themselves and the world, and one should try to redeem even inadequate understandings. You know, that Nietzsche quote again about people who, you know, redeem the past and the future and don't want the present, I think is maybe, like, the way what communists should be. I don't know if other people have thoughts.
I was curious about how we keep mentioning freedom and this sort of assumption that we're not currently free until some other system comes about. Because it seems to me that if that's what Marx is assuming, or what communists are assuming, then it doesn't really seem like there's any actual escape from the sense of, like, we're always going to be fighting something. I don't know, one of the things that seemed to be apparent for me when you're discussing notions of us being unfree right now, and maybe I'm wrong, is this sort of ideal instead of like time travel, like space travel, where to be free means that like in your current moment you can like be wherever, whoever, in anything you want to be, sort of, which to me seems like just ultra like limited liberal of like the present day. And I just, wouldn't it be a little bit more realistic to understand that we already all are free, that we're like born into certain, like a certain soft shell, but then you're just, you are free within that moment, whether that leads you to life or death or whatever radical action that's going to entail from where you're born. But why does there have to be like some sort of ideal state that you're like born into or are in for there to be freedom? Like, it just seems rather pastoral, a little bit immature.
I mean, I think that like, so a couple things. One, I think the claim is like an imminent one, that the demand for freedom is a relatively new historical demand. And the demand for freedoms becoming more and more absolute is a relatively new historical demand. So, for instance, like when the Spartacus uprising happens in ancient Rome and like slaves are throwing off the yoke of their masters, what they're not demanding is like the end of slavery in Rome. They just want to run away and get like their own little plot of land where they can live away from these masters and defend themselves against the masters, right? The idea that like Roman slavery as such is a historical wrong is like not right. To me, that seems like a quintessentially modern idea. Like it's a way we can think about the past that actually agents might not have been able to think about. So too, it seems like things like, I mean, a number of things, but things like determination through class, the kind of determination of one's life outcomes, etc. But I think more substantially, the issue of whether one's time in life is being used for self-development or is being used to reproduce oneself. I mean, I think in the, you know, the economic philosophic manuscripts, Marx calls it the, you know, what is most human is most animal, what is most animal is what is most human. Like, for the vast majority of the world, what is their, like, daily life activity, what should be creative, a means of self-realization, etc., is drudgery, is boring at the very least, if not, like, horrible and life-threatening at the very worst.
Isn't there a way in which we kind of participate in that sort of sense? Isn't there a way in which we freely participate in this, what we call unfreedom? It seems like it's not, it doesn't seem like it's something that just, there's a way in which it's almost this myth, it becomes a mythical thing, our unfreedom, as if freedom isn't something that's actually participated in. So you can say, you know, like, oh, there's this drudgery to what you're doing every day, but there's a sense in which you participate and you enter into that. There are radical acts that people do that we say no to, that we will not go to a certain extent to, in our practice of freedom, to escape it. And I mean, that's like, it's a huge, massive range, because there are dangers, obviously, engendered by certain acts that are possible for each of us. And that's true here, it's true in a war-torn country. There's so many things that we can look at and say, and that's why we say something like, oh, that takes courage, oh my gosh, you know what I mean? So I guess I'm just, I understand exactly what somebody's pointed to in saying, like, I don't feel free. But I guess I don't really see how I'm not freely making the choice to be constrained. Because it seems like people often make this choice to be constrained, even if it's because it's something that a rational person would say, well, to not be constrained, I too would not go that far.
I mean, I think that what you're tapping into is this sort of tension between individual freedom, ways in which I make sense of what is available to me as possibilities, and my agency to say no or yes, ways in which to change my situation as an individual. But within those constraints of possibility, which I can say yes or no, those are outside of my control to a certain extent. Like, I as like a worker in New York have like certain things that I can
One is the idea that a number of the things you said that, like, after the if I do that, then
yeah.
are part of what capitalism is trying to guarantee for us anyway, is the way in which it controls us, which is quality of life, like this kind of home or XYZ. I mean, there are certainly many, we know that there are many different climes in this place, and if you have a certain amount of freedom of movement, you'll be able to go to certain places. And if enough people did that and actually exercise their freedom, then something would have to change more radically. But I don't think that people are en masse. I think that there's almost like a prisoner's dilemma where it's like, if I, maybe I would go this far, but if that guy doesn't go this far and that guy also doesn't go this far, I'm the only one who's going to be fucked.
That's right.
And I'm going to be without home and life insurance. But if everyone did it, then we'd all be fine.
Well, I mean,
Second thing, too, is that you then said you also made a leap from freedom to control. You were talking about, what you can't control, where you are born and everything like that. And that's precisely what I'm talking about. There's a complete difference between freedom and control. And that difference is what leads someone from a society, an ideal society, I guess, to a fascist society. And I think that's why there's so often, you start with one and so often lead into another. Because controlling the things that are around you and being able to do things the way you want to do them is not freedom. That's control. Freedom is being where you are and then freely acting.
Well,
hold on, Sid.
You have something to say.
No, it's okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
Alright.
Well, I was just going to say you had a critique earlier about defining freedom as freedom of mobility and how that would be quite different than. I mean, I guess here then, I guess the bigger question is what do we mean by freedom? And, you know, one can pose it as freedom of mobility, right? Freedom within, like, particular boundaries of the world. My freedom to go to wherever I want at whatever time I can.
Right, and when I say mobility, of course, I mean it like in a broader sense, not just like to get like literally from point like 14th Street to 23rd,
yeah.
but also obviously like psychologically, like the freedom to, you know, I'm born a man, I'm going to become a woman, all, like the kind of idea of like moving through and changing identities and also location and everything like that. Yeah.
Well, no, I was thinking, I mean, so those things that are appear to be outside of my own control, like, you know, as you know, I would want to have health insurance. Right, that is free because it's important for my life. That isn't as an individual, like right now, that doesn't seem to be under my control. Like I can't sort of go somewhere. It's not within my conditions of possibility to simply go somewhere and say, okay, well, I want to have health insurance now and I want it to be free, and it will happen.
But if you say I want
right?
health insurance, you're already assuming a certain system, which means you're willing to make certain capitulations
within
the system, and therefore you should play by the rules of the system.
But
you didn't want health insurance,
but
you just want to be healthy, then you want to overthrow the entire system.
But that's the threshold. I mean, and this is the last thing I'll say, the tension between individual and society, that, like, sure, I guess you could pose it as like capitulating to a particular system. I can't exist outside of certain. Like, I, as a social individual that reconstitute myself every day, do have to play by certain rules or terrible things could happen to me. And I think that the question then is how to address those limitations politically in such a way that they don't become the burden of one individual having to either A, like, sleep on the street or not having enough food for the day or et cetera. Like, how do they actually sort of, how do you begin to address those social limitations so that the conditions and the possibility of the individual are bigger?
If I could say one more thing before, because I keep on talking, but I would say to that I think, in a sense, even when you were saying that people's critique for Marx might be that he focuses so much on, or doesn't focus on, like, the individual or some this sort of matter, I think it may even be because I think that once you get into wealth and those kinds of concerns, those are purely social matters. And I wonder about the idea of, it seems like the concerns that you're raising don't seem to go far enough, and they seem to assume a limitation, which I just think if you're going to make that assumption, you've already entered into a certain game. So I don't know how you could apply, how do you apply something, a radical idea or a radical set of ideas or notions or critique to a system that can't abide it? What's the point of it? I don't understand.
Well, I mean, we're talking about Marx, and he says, you know, progress, we don't immediately come into communism. But the idea behind it was go into socialism in a certain part, and then from there, the interactions between individuals and the interactions between ideals create a new system. So one day, we'll, you know, Hegelian dialectic.
we'll get to the perfect system.
I mean, that's what
and
I'm saying.
But you just
have
to suffer now.
We have a question or comment behind it.
Yeah, this is a question. This is a very simple question. I think that maybe this is sort of underlying what your debate here is about, kind of, right? This is a very simple question because I don't know about much about this kind of stuff, right? But in this discussion about, like, how now there's kind of like a lack of freedom because capitalism, I guess you're born into a certain position, it's very difficult to move out of it sometimes. What, maybe he doesn't say this, but what does it look like in whatever other system he's proposing that makes the society more free or people in a society more free?
Okay, so
what is the more freedom like?
Okay,
like, I don't know what that's like.
That actually brings us back to the first question I asked about, you know, determining what the future could look like, if that's even possible at all, and if that's even desirable to determine it. But the question of freedom, there's a few things I wanted to say. I hope they relate somehow. But the one thing that I think Jeremy was trying to get at is the kind of contradictory nature of reality that we're in under capital, meaning that we're both free and not free simultaneously, right? So basically, I am an individual who is free to sell my labor in the market any way I choose. I could pick whatever trade I want to train in. You know, I have certain limitations, of course, but I could, you know, become a banker tomorrow if I train myself to do that, or I could, you know, be a truck driver. I have my freedom to sell my labor power any way I wish. But then we have the problem where, like, we're in the economic downturn, right? So if, you know, like, let's say I wanted to be a truck driver and my best friend owned a company, and I went to him and I said, you know, dude, hook me up, hire me, we're good friends, you know, I'm reliable. But he said, oh, I can't do it because the economy just won't allow me to hire you right now. So in that case, both I'm unfree and so is the person that I'm asking to hire me, because he's not free to hire a friend because he can't afford it, nor am I free to get the job that I want to do, even though, you know, I could probably do it. So we treat the economy as if it were second nature, even though it is the activity of our own doing. Thus, you know, it's kind of dominating us in a certain way. Which leads me to another point, where we were talking about the limitations of freedom, you know, like, oh, I want to be able to get health insurance, but I can't afford it or whatever. There's two different understandings of freedom that are, I don't really entirely understand because they're hard to wrap your head around, but I think it could be posed this way, of freedom to choose versus freedom to transform. Freedom to choose is kind of like a little mantra that Milton Friedman came up, meaning that, like, you know, neoliberal capitalism is the best of all possible worlds because one could choose what kind of commodity you could buy. You're not dictated by some state saying that these are the only boots you could buy. You have a multitude of choices of what kind of boots you want to get. But freedom to transform, I think, is something more what Marx is getting at, is, you know, what are the possibilities in the present, in its current social structure, that leaves us somehow dominated, but nonetheless allows for the potential to transform beyond that social system that constrains us. And I think that's kind of what you were trying to get at with Pam, is like, oh, well, you assume that a certain social system is in place. The imagination should be something like, I can't afford health insurance, all my friends and family can afford health insurance, in what ways is it possible for me and, you know, a cohort of people to mobilize in order to make that freedom possible? How can we transform the social system that's in place in order to make that, you know, rather than some kind of privilege, a right to all?
I mean, can I just say, I think it's related to the claim that this is because we, in fact, as a society, are what have produced the capacity for everyone to have health insurance. So it's not like here's me and here's society,
mm-hmm.
and sort of like I'm the lone individual horribly facing the onslaught of a society, and the society's rules are made up by somebody, not me, maybe 1,000 years ago, whatever. I think the claim is that Marx's conception, you know, it's what he calls alienation, is that society itself is made up by our activity, is made up by our behaving in patterned ways. This society has produced certain kind of capacities that the vast majority of us would actually want. But there are some profound difficulties in this society, in fact, maybe absolute limitations, towards realizing those capacities. And what collective action, the reason why proletariat action, why anyone cares, why one should care at all, is that it's exactly the attempt to kind of change the rules of that game, to say, actually, if we collectively change our behavior, change our making society, then society itself will change, because we are the ones who make society. And so in some ways, Amok, I think I agree with you that it is like me and my everyday decisions that make society what it is.
If everybody gets together and walks out,
that's right.
That's a thing. But I mean, how often do you see that happen in the ghettos of America, that everybody just gets together and says, you know what, like, actually, enough. And it seems like if that were more the message, instead of saying, you need to like fight for different points of a liberal agenda, like why, you know, whatever Obama says in the next election, instead of it was saying, you know, fuck Obama, I'm just going to the street at this point, and we're not, none of us in Detroit are working anymore,
mm-hmm.
and we're both gonna, we're all gonna stand there, you know, then I think that that would be a far, that would be more of a radical answer, more of a radical choice. I'd be making the leap from choice to transformation, as you would say.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think Marx thinks that collective self-action directed outwards towards society and directed inwards, so all the kinds of things that happen when people gather together and start educating themselves and one another and, you know, etc., like that is the process of what freedom would look like. Now, whether that happens in one sort of like big burst or whether that requires like long scale organization, it requires like kind of slow methodical motion, etc., I mean, those are some ways details, but I think agree that in some ways, a lot of problems in our thinking come from like thinking like I'm here, society's there, like I'm the lone rebel facing a nasty external order that I can do nothing about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of this sort of very, I don't know, older idea that communism is sort of a program that is to be achieved, and I guess for myself, when I read Marx, I more see it as sort of a very active movement itself. To put it more concretely, I think like anything like what's going on in Egypt, sort of strike or any sort of general strike, you see what Marx would call a violation of value, the very system of capitalism for certain its own value and the construction of value. For those who may or may not know what value is, it's essentially kind of a dual part of a commodity. And we produce things in order to sell them for other things, but for profit moreover. When you see people in the streets of Egypt cleaning up Tahrir Square without any compulsion of someone telling them to or paying them, you know, when you see people providing free medical care in that situation, that is a glimpse of communism. That is a violation of value as I see it. I don't see it so much as a program, but an active movement. And the more and more it gets broadened and widened, I think the more we can possibly see it. I think the role of communists, at least how I understand it in the manifesto, is not necessarily to sort of dictate or bark orders, but to help people understand that what you're fighting for now is exactly what we need to keep going for. What is the final end of the society? Not so much localizing the demands, but trying to push it further out. Like, this is what exactly you're fighting for. Not to simply dictate orders or anything like that. So that's how I kind of grasp what communism does. So not so much this program where we sit with a piece of paper and draw a crayon and have no sun and all those happy people. So I think it's much more of an active movement.
I mean, the only caveat I would say is that I do think one has to put an important element of critique in that too, because like, so for instance, like workers are like resisting power when like white workers strike but won't let blacks in their union, like won't let blacks in the city because they're worried that they'll be strike breakers, right? So that's a form of like worker resistance, worker power, like, but it's certainly not, I would hope, what communism would look like.
That's a limitation on the system.
Right,
right?
So,
I mean, obviously,
so I think like,
yeah.
To some extent what I, let me just finish and then, sorry, I apologize. What I think Marx, the emphasis of critique in the manifesto is exactly that, to some extent, the limitation of those demands can often not only hurt other, like not only hurt the mission, but also hurt other people in the working class, et cetera. Like, and so that part of what communists are there to do is critique limitations. And so saying that, I mean, yes, them cleaning up Tahrir Square voluntarily is great, but it's also the military told them, like, the revolution's done, go home, and like the revolution was done. And a lot of them, I mean, not everyone has gone home, but like the fact that they're essentially taking orders from the military in some ways there points to, I think, a pretty profound limitation of how communist the moment of them, you know, sweeping the square voluntarily is in some sense, because I certainly hope it wouldn't be a, you know, military state apparatus that would be telling
people
what to
do. This text, but in the 18th for Mayer, that's kind of the limitation right there. And I think in terms of America, you bring up white and black workers, I mean, class is racialized in America, as is in other parts. I mean, that's exactly the limitations. I mean, the white workers can only go so far until they realize that when they exclude their black brothers, I mean, that's it. I mean, the movement collapses. So it has to be very self-critical, and I think that's exactly the point. When they're in a struggle, communists need to, that is their role, is to constantly point these limitations out.
There's a little some like myths that proliferate, partially on the part of capitalism, to sort of, I don't know, put off more radical elements of communists from really carrying forth the struggle. I
think what went on in Egypt with, you know, bourgeois leaving while the workers are still struggling, it was a very clear thing set from the front out, and as a reader, that this is what I saw, which was like, we're not leaving until Mubarak's out. And that's what they said. Had they said it was, we're not leaving until other thing,
right,
then maybe they would have stayed there longer. But to them, it was like, well, we got the thing and we're leaving. So I don't think it's like just kind of a like, fuck you, we got ours. It was like, we got ours, right? And they're like, oh no, and you didn't say that at the beginning. And I just, you know what I mean? I think with like the racial thing, I mean, I just don't, yes, it is a real big part, I mean, obviously, of our history, but I think there's an extent to which we now just kind of go as zombies about the whole race issues in America. And some of these things, I mean, one of my favorite story was from the Henry Louis Gates thing that happened in Boston, when he's, you know, going in and like, oh, like they're arresting me because I'm, you know, whatever, I'm black and I'm going into a big house and da da da. When in reality, I mean, when you actually look at the situation, which is just shocking to me, Henry Louis Gates comes back, first of all, wearing like the preppiest outfit that like God's ever put on the earth. And then he's going into a place with this guy from like this cop who's like probably like from Southie or something. And he says to him, how dare you even speak to me? Like basically saying like something like, I was just interviewing Yo-Yo Ma. How dare you speak to me?
Why don't you treat me like my class, not my race? Like,
you know,
my class,
you know,
is what matters.
You know what happens? The cop said, Yo Mama, Yo Mama. And he arrested him. Because he thought it was a total class difference. He thought he was saying Yo Mama because he didn't know who Yo-Yo Ma was. And that's why he arrested him with his face. And this whole idea that we think, like, oh, let's go share a beer because he was, like, racist against having those gays. No, he wasn't. He was classist because he fucking couldn't believe this, like, prick was going on telling him his mother sucked. So it's, like, this kind of total misunderstanding of, like, race and class and the extent to which we've just, that it just mystify everything. And I think it does come from a more capitalist, like...
Well, I think, you know, I sympathize with the idea of, I mean, what I find most frustrating about going to conversations when the left is part of the discussion is that the way in which the left explains its inability to create the revolution is by saying capitalism didn't allow us to do it, or the right, which is necessarily bound up with capitalism, didn't allow us to create the revolution, right? And I think that, you know, in part, there's this question that what does it matter, this consciousness of history of the left really matter in sort of thinking about how to wage a revolutionary movement today. You know, is it just about then putting people in the street or recognizing that people are struggling in the world and then saying here is where people are actually fighting against oppressive forces? And you know, I think that there's a real problem because actually that is an irresponsible position vis-a-vis the world. It seems to me that, you know, that's right. Well, we're saying Mubarak, go home. A lot of people left because of that. How do we understand that? Do we say, okay, well, you know, we can say several things. Well, fuck the middle class. The middle class is not reliable enough. Like, Mubarak went home, and then, like, oh, Mubarak's down, so now they went home. Like, that's one way, I guess, of sort of thinking about it. And then you can just say, well, fuck the middle class. We really need to organize workers, and blah, blah, blah. But another way in which we could understand this is, like, well, what would have happened? We were just talking about this with another primary. Like, what would have happened if, like, there was an international leftist movement that was in place, was organized, and had, like, you know, representatives of their organizations or an active sort of, like, culture of, like, discussion in places like Egypt that would have taken the opportunity of people going to the streets and protesting against, like, this person as an opportunity to, like, radicalize demands, talk to people about their social limitations, sort of think about, you know, there are strikes right now, there were strikes before this, like, there's the context is not only capitalism, it's I think also the absence of a left that allows for things to sort of continue to not lead anywhere. And I think my frustrations with conversations about the left has been, well, you know, really the history of the left has been history of the triumphs of the right. Well, it has been that, but only insofar as we understand them also as failures of the left.
I think you're completely right, because I think even when you're talking about that now, you're saying, you know, if you have, I had never even heard that kind of idea about Egypt as it being like the middle class leaving. Because for me, watching all those events unfold, I mean, that started in Tunisia. And on, you know, when they were in Tahrir Square, people in Tunisia were still fighting, saying, like, I'm standing up for my Egyptian brothers. And so, I mean, how much more far from you can it get if somebody from, like, the bourgeois of a completely other country is standing there for you? And I think that, yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. I think that the left also is really frustrating because, in a sense, they sort of misidentify continue saying that workers are anyone, proletariat is anybody with radical potential, is anyone who's like below this like income barrier and has this color skin, and like anybody who's like just being oppressed, then we're going to completely miss out on what actually is making up the revolutionary class in at least today's America, because, you know, somebody who's living in a project but their only aim is to be like that rapper they saw and like get like gold chains is certainly not going to sit there and go to Harvard Square with you. That's not the person. So I think there's a problem with the blacks. I think they sort of, they do mystify what it means.
That's a good point you bring up, because a lot of Jeremy's presentation hinged on the idea of subjectivity and political consciousness, right? So, I mean, just by virtue of being oppressed, or by being someone who is sociologically of the working class, or someone who may be a minority of race or sex or age, you know, all the plethora of things that are thrown out there, doesn't necessarily mean that one would become radicalized by that. Right, it's a matter of, you know,
being a fascist.
Exactly. I mean, you saw what happened in Germany. It was largely supported by the peasants. Fascism was largely supported by the peasants and the working class. So I mean, that's something
middle
that
class.
Middle class. Yeah, that's very true. And
some workers.
Yeah, some workers. But yeah, my historical knowledge should be better, I guess. My consciousness should be better. But I mean, that's something that we should also talk about too, because of the common discourse we hear on the left is, you know, like, you know, about, you know, the worker being the essence of, you know, radicalism, where it, you know, may not necessarily be the case.
It's like sadomasochist, you know what I mean? Some people just because you hear a scream from the bedroom doesn't mean something, but the person doesn't enjoy it. And I think that you have to understand that, like, actually one of the craziest things about domination and fascism is that some people who are being dominated and who have a fascist leader actually don't have a problem with it, even if they're on the lowest end, they're getting nothing. You just look to the South where they fight to not have economic rights. I'm saying in our country, where they're not moving on terms of the economic issues.
Somewhat, although, I don't know, I just feel like it's a mix, because, like, if you poll workers in the South, all of them are like, yeah, I'd love to have a union. Like, really, like, a vast majority are like, yes, I would love to have a union, but they vote for Republicans who don't, like, are actively against giving them unions. So it's a weird,
when it comes to the time, you know, when it comes to the time to act, it's like, oh, I guess I'll choose to be... Partially, I think, because of the myths that are still going out there about what is, you know, going on.
But that's actually, look at Wisconsin, even. They just,
perfect example.
Yeah, they just came on. I mean, I was listening to the conversation. One of the strike leaders was doing Democracy Now. And the conversation was, it's the Republicans doing this.
Yeah.
It's not a conversation about, it's the government itself as a whole. It's the Democrats and the Republicans all, you know. But it's them.
Yeah.
Not us.
Obama would be perfectly happy to see all teacher unions disappear tomorrow.
Then,
so there's,
you know,
no, like,
yeah, there's no discussion about that. It's just, you know, trying to pin the blame on somebody, you know, in this case Walker, and then having them done. So.
I mean, it does raise, I mean, it's sort of like returning to the sort of subjective factor of like the left or sort of history. Thinking about what role a left could play in a situation in which workers want an independent union but vote Republican. Like, you know, like what role, if any, could a left play, like a left that has like a sort of radical goals? And in that situation, it largely is about consciousness. I mean, it largely is about, you know, it, not even convincing this person that they want like an independent union. That's there, that's available. The question is that why doesn't this individual associate the desire for an independent union and workers' representation with a more radical political force that is not yet actually active in the world, and how could one interact with this individual to actually create the possibilities, the conditions under which that could become a real possibility, as opposed to having this person vote Republican, right? And so, I mean, it does have this, it just raises issues, at least for us today, about the role of consciousness vis-a-vis politics that I'm personally interested in, sort of thinking about, you know, the role of a potential left in the present. That there's a lot of, I think, the idea of like wading through shit, whatever, like, you know,
shovel,
you know, like a shovel, you know, like there's just a lot of shit out there. I mean, not even just on the right, I mean, to the Republican Party, but also on the left, right? And so then it becomes the question of like criticism. Then, it, you know, Laura's question about how is it that Marxist critique, you know, like critiquing people at their best, at what they like sort of most desire, and yet in their sort of attempt to achieve these things end up sort of undermining
Yeah.
I think it's funny, because I was just saying this short anecdote, because it's funny how much, you know, when we talk about like psychoanalysis or something, but how much like the consciousness takes time, like lags a little bit. And I think that is for the radicals, I think maybe understanding that lag and being comfortable with it and having faith with what comes after the lag might be part of the key to their success. And one of our friends, Charlie, had been helping in the Obama election. And he was working in North Carolina. And when they had a whole like town hall meeting and everything, you know, people were arguing over the table about who they're gonna vote for, and it was really, you know, like, you know, just real rednecks, you know, sitting around the table. And finally one guy, he stands up, he says, "You know what? Damn it, I'm voting for a nigger." And he walks out. And this understanding that you can still like say like I'm voting for the nigger, but mean that I like the nigger even though I say the word nigger. And that's who I'm going with. And that's like the way that things move. And to understand that like maybe there might be a problem with the radicals always associating with a certain left and right. And that maybe if we transcended left and right, we get more, there'd be more people who understood what we were talking about. Because I think that there's a sense coming, I grew up in the South, that once you say radical, you also have to have a subscription to the New Yorker, which is wholly like unradical. And so it's weird the ways like the sort of grouping we do that like actually does not serve us well at all.
I kind of want to wrap the conversation back into Jeremy's presentation, because we were talking about the crux of the matter being political consciousness. How can we raise political consciousness to be adequate to take up the tasks of our time, right? But then that leaves me wondering, you know, if Marx understood this too and it's really about consciousness, then why talk about the proletariat at all, right? So how, I guess this is a Jeremy for question, or ultimately anyone if they want to respond to it. So how is it for Marx that the proletariat plays in raising political consciousness, especially if someone of the upper class could be politically conscious enough to support something that could be considered a radical cause? And also, what would it mean today, considering that we still have a proletariat in term, you know, sociologically, but we don't have class consciousness the same way we did during Marx's time?
Well, wait a minute. There's a difference between the proletariat and the working class.
The
proletariat is the critique of work itself. It's the critique of the working class. It's when you finally come to the world, you know, when they finally come to the realization, like, oh my gosh, like, this shit. The working class is, oh, exactly, you know, the using thing. I wouldn't use that word. N-word or whatever like that, because I didn't feel really uncomfortable. But it's like that being sexist, racist, and all that stuff. I mean, that is the working class, let's be honest. It's a reactionary base. And I think we have to kind of flesh out the term. Sorry that we're talking so personally on this, but I think that's it though. It's that we shouldn't also seek sociological definitions for class either.
So you're saying that proletariat, by definition, is a form of consciousness?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think the working class is something that I would hope it would achieve to become proletariat. But I think the working class, no, I mean, it's mostly.
That's very good. That's nice. Very
good. That was related to the substance of your comment.
No, I mean, I think that's right. I think, you know, it's important. There is a relationship between the working class and the proletariat. And that, you know, and because the hope is that something which is, you know, I mean, you know, on the most obvious level, in some sense, if we all in capitalist society are in some ways, like, buffeted about by forces beyond our understanding, by big social processes, etc., like, the claim is that workers, to some extent, have an experience of this in a very everyday way, insofar as they are like the objects. They are the commodities. Like, you know, the bourgeois, like, you know, can calculate commodities on a list. The worker, like, I am the commodity. And I think the claim that, like, that offers a certain kind of potential, but it certainly doesn't decide anything about what is going to end up happening, I think is key. Yeah, I think we're long past the days of, like, inevitability that Marx was pretty sure of. I think because of his moment, like, because it did, at least to some extent, look like things were on the rise, even if he was also dealing with moments of failure of bourgeois politics as well. Like, there's a mix in the history, I think, of politics in the 19th century, of liberals, Marxists, etc., of, like, real sort of confidence in the future that, unfortunately, in some ways, I wish I could feel now. It would be nice. What'd you say?
The least crisis.
Yeah, man.
Well, I think it's important though, just like
Austin, Ohio.
That's right.
Just like what's the first thing, socialism or barbarism. There's no whole decadence theory, right, you know, the idea in Marx, oh, well, you know, we're so confident history's on our side, you know, we can just simply watch, you know, watch this whole process unravel itself. It's like, no, it's, there are two things. We degenerate into God knows what, or we go into, or we actually take the kind of this very conscious act of transforming it. And it's one or the other. Like, there's no guarantee. I think the left makes that mistake constantly. I see it in all the, most of the Marxist theorists, and I think even, you know, Marx being in a very historic moment almost kind of made that mistake as well. I think he kind of recovers from that later in his works, but I think that's exactly it. It has to be a conscious act.
Which I think is, I mean, that's why I gave that Engels quote, because I think that particularly for me, like, really says that, like, that every step of civilization is one of regression and barbarism as well. And so what that means is sort of like the character of all of human progress is like open for question. Like, it depends on us whether human history will be like a story with a stirring ending, or will just be like a flop B movie that can barely make it out of your parents' basement. Like, maybe. Have you ever read the Canticle for Libras? Okay, so should we
say before we finish up? All right, well, everyone, let's give Jeremy one more round of applause. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Will you have your whole thing online?
I have a recording right here.
Yeah, so we'll post this.
Or, I mean, the writing itself.
I'll think about it.